as a general rule, and a trip to greengrocer make me blow my cool. Don't give me no turnips, no summer squash, just an old rutabaga from the rutabaga bush.
I do the rutabaga boogie
all the time. With that fresh rutabaga, pull it right off the vine.
Well, good morning. Welcome to the KBOO Food Show. That was Rutabaga Boogie by Briar Rose. And my name is Bruce.
I'm Roberta.
And I'm Kate.
And today on the food show, we have three features for you. Roberta is going to have an interview explaining the WIC program, WIC, Women, Infants, and Children. It's a nutrition program. And then our interview with Farmer John Peterson. Star of the movie The Real Dirt on Farmer John. He was in town recently, and we got to talk with him. And then we're going to take a brief audio visit to yet another farmer's market here in Portland, one on North Interstate Avenue that opened this year. Let's get right into it with Roberta and her guest on the WIC program.
My guest is Sue Woodbury. She's from the director of the Oregon WIC program. Good morning, Sue.
Good morning,
good
Roberta.
You
thank you.
Oh, I think a lot of people are aware there is a WIC program, but they don't know exactly what it is and how it works. So what does WIC stand for, and how did it get started?
WIC stands for the Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, and it started in 1974 as a public health program to safeguard the health of low-income mothers and children and families in the United States. There's four main goals. One is to provide nutritious food, supplemental food, not the entire meals that a person would have. One is to educate young families about the importance of good nutrition and physical activity. We provide information and support for breastfeeding mothers, and then also referrals to other health care services.
And when it started as a federal program or a state program?
It's a federal program funded out of the United States Department of Agriculture, but it's administered in each state or Indian tribal organization or territory by the state organization.
So this is one of those state programs, so that where the money is really a pass-through, is federal money, but it's passed through to the states?
Correct. And then within the state, we contract with local agencies to provide the direct services. In Oregon, we have 34 contracts. 30 are local health departments, 2 are tribal organizations, and 2 are nonprofit organizations.
So it's fairly available then to people in lots of communities around the state.
Absolutely. We have availability in every area of the state of Oregon.
So who is eligible, and how would someone go about applying?
Well, you've got to be a woman, child, or infant to be eligible. And as a woman, you need to be pregnant or up to 2 months postpartum. Breastfeeding, if you're a breastfeeding mom, you can be on the program for 12 months after delivery. An infant or a child up to their 5th birthday.
Yeah.
And then you also, those are, you know, the criteria of who. You also have to be a resident and live within an area that WIC services, which in Oregon is the entire state. And by resident, I mean someone who lives locally. You need to have a household income that's less than 185% of the federal poverty level. And to tell you what that means, it's $1,511 a month for a household of one. It's $3,084 for a household of four. And any foster child is eligible because they're considered a household of one. And then you also have to have a nutritional need or risk. You need to be anemic. A pregnant teenager is at nutritional risk. Someone who has a poor diet or poor growth in children specifically, or there's several other health needs that we screen for. And in Oregon, we serve 172,000 people in 2005. 40% of the infants born in the state had WIC services provided to their mother prior to their birth. 51% of the infants born in the rural areas.
But you do not have to have some sort of a medical disability in order to apply for the program. It just has income limits.
And the nutrition risk or need. So you have to, again, being anemic, being a pregnant teenager, having poor growth, a child who is not showing a normal growth, a poor diet if you're, because of your income level, unable to eat an adequate diet, that's another screening factor.
So someone is low income, but the child seems to be growing normally, they would not necessarily be eligible?
Not necessarily, but probably we find that low income and the poor diet correlate very significantly. And so the income really is income and being in the right category, being a mom or a child under the age of five, they all have nutritional risks.
Mm-hmm. I just want our listeners to be aware if there are any special hoops they have to hop through in order to get on the program.
There really isn't. They would contact their local county health department or check with SafeNet, the 211 number in Oregon, and they'd be given a number to call in their local area. When they apply, they have to show proof of identity, that they are who they say, and they have to be physically present. They have to show proof of income and proof of residency. And that proof of residency could be a utility bill with their name on it and their address.
And how long does the residency have to be if they're new in the state?
That's fine. They just have to show current residency.
Okay. When I hear about WIC, I hear that they have vouchers or coupons. How does that work?
When a participant is eligible, they, based on the category that they are, if they're a pregnant woman or a breastfeeding woman or an infant or a child, there's a food package prescribed for them. So it's a group of foods that they would be offered under the WIC program, and those foods print on a voucher that the participant would take to a local grocery store and use to redeem to get those food items.
So the food package is something they go purchase themselves.
They do go purchase themselves. It's prescribed as to what they can purchase, but they purchase themselves. And in Oregon, we have over 640 grocery stores that participate in the WIC program.
So is there a dollar limit on the coupon?
There isn't a dollar limit. It's only the food items prescribed on there.
Then how does the grocery store handle those?
They deposit them just like they would a check that you or I write, and it goes through the banking system, and its monies are transferred to the store's bank account.
I notice also that the people at the farmers market are saying that they accept the WIC vouchers. How would they do them, the same way?
It's a similar program. At the farmer's market, it's called the WIC Farmers Market Nutrition Program. And participants who are eligible for that, who there has to be a farmer market or farm stand in the community, they also have to be over 6 months of age. An infant isn't able to eat those items, and so they wouldn't qualify. They receive checks in the value of $2, and a participant in Oregon would receive 10 $2 checks or $20 in benefit that they can spend at farmers markets or farm stands that are authorized to participate in the program. They're $2 because you can't give change back, so it's an easy amount to negotiate and spend at a farmer's market.
I see. So there's no cash return for anything?
No. And the farmers, again, deposit those in their checking account just like any other check.
I noticed that you talked about the food basket. Who determines what's going to be in it and what quality or brand of foods?
Sure. USDA really sets the regulations of the type foods that can be included in a WIC food package. Then each state is able to look at the foods, look at their population, you know, what type of, you know, participants do they have, look at availability of foods in their area, and make a determination of what they're going to include in the foods available to participants in their state.
Are there some brands that are on, like if somebody was going to buy a particular kind of fruit? I noticed in the grocery store occasionally they'll have a little sticker on the by the counter saying qualifies for WIC, and it's under one brand but not under another of the same
Correct.
Kind of thing.
Correct. And one of the reasons is that cereals have to be iron fortified. There's a group of nutrients that participants in WIC are at high risk of being having a diet that's inadequate in. And it's calcium, iron, vitamins A, C, and D, and so, and as well as proteins. So there's regulations from USDA about how much vitamin C a juice product has to have. So one brand may have the required amount where another brand may not. In cereals, if it's not an iron-fortified cereal, it's not going to qualify for the program because we're really looking at supplemental foods that hit targeted needs nutritionally.
Does the USDA go pick up the product and test it?
We require, as we go through and put our food list together, we require that manufacturers send us scientific documentation of the nutritional content of their foods. So we know that the government requires that food manufacturers test the nutrient content, that they post some of those nutrients on their package. So we just accept what their testing shows. USDA doesn't go out and do a separate test for WIC foods.
So if I had a marvelous new drink on the market that I thought would be good for WIC qualified folks to use, how would I go about getting that on the list?
You could contact the state WIC office and send them the information. You could also contact USDA and let them know that you've got a product that would be available nationally.
Okay. When I go through the grocery store line, they have some way that they can check whether or not this orange juice qualifies and that orange juice doesn't?
No. We train our grocery store vendors, and they train all of their employees, as well as the WIC participants. They have a picture guide of what products are allowed to be used and purchased with the WIC voucher. So it's predetermined for them. And it does require that the shopper look at the product and choose the appropriate ones, but that helps them learn how to make good, nutritious choices in the foods they're choosing. And hopefully they continue that after their family has grown and is no longer qualified to participate in WIC.
So it sounds like there's a real training element involved with your program.
It's a huge nutrition education program. We really want to train people to live a healthy life their entire life, not just while they've got young children at home.
Mm-hmm. And you're also training the clerks.
We are. You know, they're learning those good foods and to choose, and they're learning a little bit about why they're being chosen.
Now, when I first called you, I talked about the possibility of people getting organic food, and you explained to me a little bit then, and I'd like for you to explain to our listeners how somebody gets organic food or not.
Organic fruits and vegetables are available for WIC participants to purchase with their Farm Direct Nutrition Program $2 checks that we talked about earlier. There's the only restrictions at a farmer market or farm stand is that it be a fresh fruit or vegetable, a culinary herb. It can't be plants. It can't be prepared food products that you find at a farmer's market. But organic or non-organically grown produce is acceptable. Within the WIC food list, when you're at a grocery store, we do not allow organics. The reason for that is that organics cost more. WIC is funded with a set dollar amount, as opposed to food stamps that gets money based on the number of eligible participants in a state. So we have a set dollar amount. We look at organics all the time. What we found is that if we, in the state of Oregon, if we allowed WIC participants to purchase organic milk, that we potentially could serve 10,000 less people. And when you're serving 172,000 people a year, you don't want to take any of those moms or kids off the program because you're allowing a more expensive food item.
So that estimate was based on everyone on the program then switching to organic?
It was. It was.
I understand the state of Washington does allow, we probably have some Washington listeners, does allow organic milk.
That is correct. And we look at it every year and determine if it's something that's financially feasible for us to do in Oregon. Also, there's a challenge that we ask our vendors to have a majority of the items on our food list. They're certain that they're required to have, but you can't find organic milk necessarily in some of our very rural communities.
We have a number of people also that talked about the nursing part of your program. Do you have a training element in teaching people how to be nursing mothers?
We're very proud of breastfeeding, our breastfeeding component, and we promote breastfeeding extensively for our participants because we believe that that's the best start that they can give their newborn child. Within the nationally, about 21% of WIC participants breastfeed. In the state of Oregon, over 54% of WIC participants initiate breastfeeding. We help support them in that by providing education at the WIC clinics. We offer classes for moms prior to delivery on breastfeeding. We have breast pumps that are loaned out from the WIC program so that a mom returning to school or work could continue to breastfeed even when they're apart from their infant for a period of time. And we also have a research grant going on right now in four agencies in the state where we're using a peer counselor program where another WIC participant who has breastfeed calls and helps that new mom make it through that initial adjustment period of breastfeeding, answers their questions, helps with their fears and concerns.
Oh, very good. That little peer support always is beneficial. Well, you certainly have given us a very good idea of what the program is about. Have I missed anything that you think is really pertinent to how you operate or something you think our listeners shouldn't know about?
Well, I think the one item I'd like people to walk away with is that WIC is a public health program and not an entitlement program, that while we provide vouchers to supplement the foods that a family purchases, that we really are educating them for now and for the future so that they can be healthy.
Oh, that's very good. And someone does not have to be on food stamps to qualify for this program?
No, absolutely not. And a lot of our participants, while they may qualify for food stamps, choose not to participate. And another misnomer is that, you know, WIC participants are all unemployed. 72% of our families are working families with at least one person in the household employed.
Well, thank you very much, Sue, for coming to talk to us. You've given us a lot of really good information, and we appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Again, for information about WIC in your area, contact your local county or tribal health department or dial 211. 211 is a toll-free social services information and referral number. It covers all of the state of Oregon and Southwest Washington. WIC's website is oregon.gov/dhs/ph/WIC.
Thank you, Roberta. And we'll repeat this contact information for this and our other reports at the end of the show. You're listening to The Food Show, a monthly feature of the Monday Radio Zine on KBOO, Community Radio in Portland. Well, next is our interview with Farmer John. John Peterson was in town the week before last. He's got a new cookbook out, vegetable cookbook, to follow the movie The Real Dirt on Farmer John, which you may have seen last winter, and you may have seen it while he was in town. There were two showings, and he made some public appearances. And he came into KBOO, and Roberta and Kate and I interviewed him. So here we are with Farmer John. John Peterson, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. Great to be back.
John, you grew up on a farm that was your father's, and your uncles and, I believe, grandfather were farmers, and it failed financially. It was after it came into your hands, you farmed for a while, and, how many acres were there, first of all, on the farm before the financial failure?
Well, the first failure was really a different kind of failure. It was my uncle's suicide. And that caused, that was when I was about 10 years old, and that caused 200 acres of the family operation to be sold, not because of money problems, but it was just broke my grandfather's heart. And so there you almost have the foreshadowing of what's to come, because I think that really indicated some weakness in the community and some change that was going on in the community that my uncle responded to. But then, so when I took over the operation, it was 186 acres, and I rented a lot of other land, so I was running 700 or 800 acres. But the 186 acres, it almost completely disappeared. I had to sell off all but 22 acres of it.
Okay, and what were you growing before?
Corn, wheat, soybeans, a little hay. We had hogs and cattle on the farm. It's quite a conventional farm. Oddly, all of us on the farm at the time were vegetarians, and we used to sit around and wonder if that was a conflict, and we always eventually came to the conclusion that it wasn't.
Well, you weren't growing food for people, though. You were growing food for animals that people would eat, right?
We were growing animals, too.
Well, yeah.
We were growing hogs and cattle, but no, we were not growing food directly for people.
Yeah, the corn and the soybeans were... Who does a farmer sell that kind of crop to?
Well, we'd just take it to the local grain elevator, and then they would load it on the rail cars. And, you know, it used to go into Chicago, and people would bid on it there. But then then the bidding became kind of abstract, and the Chicago Board of Trade people would bid on it, but they didn't really even know the physical product they were bidding on. I once sent a trader a soybean plant. He traded on the Chicago Merck, and I sent him a soybean plant because he traded soybean futures, and he said he had never seen a soybean plant. So he taped it to the podium where all these people stood in front of to do their trading, to yell and shout and scream. And like, what is that? He says, well, that's a soybean plant. That's what you guys are trading every day. So it got disassociated. Chicago, which was the mecca for the actual produce or the actual commodity at one time, it ceased to be that, and then just this trading would go on there, and now it you know, it gets shipped. It just goes into worldwide channels,
mm-hmm.
barges down the Mississippi, and then who knows where it goes, all over the world.
When you were growing these plants, you were growing them with chemicals, using
I was a conventional farmer.
Okay,
a conventional farmer. And we were running the farm with a bunch of hippies and idealists. So it was really an interesting thing to have this kind of tension between these ideals and then the practicality of that kind of farming. And it is a practical kind of farming. I mean, it gets the work done, and you don't have the weeds and the bugs. But
did you grow a kitchen garden for the vegetarians?
No. We had no garden then. We were all busy working, farming.
So you actually went to the supermarket for your groceries?
Oh, yeah. Now, that's a super... In the 50s or the early 60s, most of the gardens on the farms in our area disappeared. My mom had 5 vegetable gardens on that farm, and then she started teaching school. That was in the... That must have been in the late 50s, and I think the farm then was starting to have some needs, some financial needs, and she thought she could supplement the income, and then she's in school, and then there go the gardens.
John, I want to compare what you were growing before with what you're growing now. What crops do you grow now on your modern organic farm, 22 acres, with some additional land now?
It's funny, I have this cookbook here in my hand, and I almost feel I should read them because there's so many crops. The cookbook has 36 chapters devoted to vegetables, but then sometimes there's more than one vegetable per chapter. So we have 40 or 50 crops that we raise, and if you break it down further, it's probably 70 or 80.
Well, a few off the top of your head.
Oh, tomatoes, melons, spinach, lettuce, peppers, squash, zucchini, eggplant, potatoes. I mean, a lot of really mainstream things, and then some more unusual things like rutabaga and celeriac and daikon radishes. And it's a major diversity of crops. I mean, then you could divide it up into, well, like according to the biodynamic model, you have 3 basic categories: leafing crops, fruiting crops, and root crops. And which I just want to say, according to that model, And according to what I profile in the cookbook, it's a different way to look at food. Rudolf Steiner said the root crops stimulate the head forces. The leafing crops stimulate the rhythmic forces, the circulation and the breathing. And the fruiting crops stimulate the will forces. And he also said that the big problem with society today is that the will forces are very weak because we don't have crops with the right forces in them. The crops are depleted because the earth is depleted. So, you know, I could say, well, we just basically do three categories or we do 70 categories.
Do you decide at the first of the year with the help of your people involved in your CSA what you're going to grow, or do you?
Well, one time we did that, but eventually, because we give a standard box, everybody basically gets the same box. And we knew that some people would just not want some of those things in that box, but we don't customize the box, so we just ballpark it. And for instance, one thing we know is that about half our people want beets and about half don't want beets. So we give them some beets and they can figure it out. They trade their beets for something they want. But now we because I'm on the road, I'm extremely busy with touring with the film and book, and there's so many things going on in my life that we've made a pretty consistent template for our year, for the crops, for the composition of the crops, and so when they're going to get planted and how much, and each bed and each row, and it tends to be pretty much the same year after year.
Well, a little bit more about your transition to organics and taking up the theme of biodynamics and what you've learned from Rudolf Steiner and his writings. The farm lay unused for, I think, about 7 years, right? And then you started trying to grow organically, something on that scale, 7 years?
Right. Well, part of it was being farmed, and then part of it was not during
okay.
the 7 years.
So you tried to start growing organically, and I remember in the movie, you didn't really know a whole lot about what you were doing, and there were a lot of bugs. In the movie, you mentioned you counted 200, I think, larvae on one plant one time.
Cucumber beetles.
Yeah. Okay, it's not like that anymore. So how did you get smart about growing organically? It must be a very detailed and slow learning curve.
That's right. That's a good thing to observe. Often people ask the question, what did you do to get rid of the bugs? And I think they want a simple answer. And it's not a simple answer. It's layering a lot of different types of management depending on the crop. It's definitely working with the fertility, and because our shareholders bought land next door, we are now able to keep half of our land fallow, so we have our fields 2 years in alfalfa and clover and 2 years in vegetables, and so we have great fertility. We have a great fertility program, and it breaks up the bug cycles when we're able to have a whole different environment of plants there two years out of four. And we use row covers. There's so many things that we do, and all of these things come together. The biodynamic methods help, I'm sure, but, we do so many things, and they've all come together so that now, for the last 4 or 5 years, we've had splendid crops every season. Isn't that amazing? I mean, being from a farm, having farmed my whole life, and seeing surprises continually on the downside, to have year after year of surprises to the upside and to see the yields and the quality get better and better, it's so exciting.
When you first were growing organically, the community-supported agriculture operation hadn't started yet. Who were you selling to?
We sold at farmers markets, which meant we had to get up around midnight the night before and get the truck packed and drive in and find a parking place. So that was pretty tough on us. And then we also sold to some store accounts. The thing that really impacted us was we had made a deal with a chain store, an organic chain outfit that said they would buy all of our squash. And they said they wanted to develop relationships with the local growers to support their mission. And then when the squash came in, and there we were sitting on tens of thousands of dollars in bills and needing to pay them, and they wouldn't return our calls. And It's very painful when, first of all, when people break their word, it's very painful. And it's very painful when the money's not there, because then I'm breaking my word. And in the meantime, this community support agriculture model had been proposed to me, and then I started to realize, wow, this is a very, very powerful model. It's based on relationships with individuals, and in this case, the individual is trusting us. The individual is taking a risk with us. The store took no risk. They just gave their word, then they easily broke it, and there we were. But this new model with community-supported agriculture, the consumer or the customer saying, here's some money, I believe in you. What a gift.
Yeah. Your mother ran a stand, roadside stand, selling some of your stuff too, right?
Oh, yeah. That was another part of the operation. My mother had her garden, and then we delivered produce down to my mom's stand, the Way and Pay.
Way and Pay, yeah.
Or is it Pay and Way?
I can't remember.
In the film, she calls it Pay and Way. So
yeah.
That's a cute title, too.
Well, she plays a major role in the film and in your life. I mean, your late mother, she's gone now.
Yeah.
But she was always supportive when you were a kid, when you're a college student, and you brought these hippies home to the farm. And then when you wanted to start this organic operation, needed some seed money, she was always supportive. Did you realize that not all mothers were like that?
Yes, I did. And it moved me very, very deeply.
Early on, even?
Probably at some point I didn't realize it. I probably assumed this was who mother was universally. But I know that I had needs and I had breakdowns in my life, and I saw a lot of people flee, and she didn't flee, and she was there for me. She loved the farm. She was very dedicated to having the farm work, but she also loved me and wanted to support me, and she did that, and she did it very fully. And it's a beautiful testimony to the power of love, and also to the importance of being there for people. And sometimes being there for people actually is enabling, and it actually is helping them to perpetuate their bad habits or their dysfunction. But I think today too many people think, oh, let's not enable this person who's on his back, because then we're just going to support this person's wrongdoing. And there were a lot of people like that in my life when the farm went down. There are a lot of people who I'd been very supportive of who didn't believe in reciprocating, because they felt that that was going to perpetuate my problems. Now, the fact was I needed money and I needed support to get back on my feet. And when I got back on my feet, I was able to get moving again.
Did your mother live long enough to see the CSA take off and know that it was going to be successful?
Yeah, she did. She was very excited about it.
That's great.
So, John, what would she think of this cookbook?
Oh, she would love the cookbook. Well, I think she tended to love whatever I was up to. So she probably would love it before she even saw it. But then she would go through it. She wouldn't get a lot of the humor in the cookbook, because it was hard to get my mom to really laugh. But she would definitely love the cookbook. It's a cookbook that's so closely related to the earth, to the farm, to the workings of the farm, and that was what was so important to my mom. Anything that has to do with the earth, my mom would love. She loved stone quarries. She loved black dirt. She loved hoeing thistles. My mom, she was very supportive, and she had a really open attitude towards so many people, so many situations. I think that must have had an effect on me. She would always say, like in our community, some people would say, oh, those people living in that house, they're trash. They shouldn't be allowed in our community. And my mother would say, but where would they live? People have to live someplace. Do you think that when those people are out of sight, that they're not living any place? Then they're living someplace else. So beautiful, and it's so simple and basic. But I just want to share the story about my mom. We had this Way and Pay. It was self-serve, so people were supposed to make their change, and people were fairly honest. They were pretty good, but they weren't impeccable. But then my mom got sick, and she had to go to the hospital, and so there was no one to go and collect the money on a regular basis. And I said, you should have this box that people put their money in. It should be locked so that someone doesn't reach in and take out all the money. And she says, well, but how would people make change? And I said, well, just have a change jar, but lock the box, and they put their money in, and it'll fill up with money, and we'll go empty it once a day. So I go down there to collect the money, and the key is right by beside the box, right beside the locked box. And I said, Mom, she was in the hospital. I said, Mom, you said you were going to lock the box. And she says, well, I did. But I said, well, the key is there. And she says, but what if people have to make change? So she did what I asked. She locked the box, and then she left the key there in case people needed to make change. That's my mom.
Your mother hasn't been the only one involved in this. Angelic Organics has a lot of other people. Can you tell us what other people do to make this whole thing work?
We have year-round staff. A lot of the people have been there now for many years, including Bob Bauer, who's the general manager there, who's keeping the farm on track while I'm on this tour. I've been on a tour for a year and a half.
Yeah, and here you are, farmer. It's June now. It's the middle of the growing season, and you're not there.
Yeah, and I call myself Farmer John. I should be Tour Guy John.
Yeah, so, I was wondering about that. How you get your crops in?
Well, he checks in with me. I spend about 350 hours coming up with a whole set of procedures and spreadsheets to transfer what I did to the people on the farm so that they would have that as a basis for running the operation. It's tough, but they're able to do it okay, and that means I'm able to be out here doing all this work. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here today. So we've had to make that compromise, but they're doing a good job. There's Bob. There's a facilities guy. There are a lot of people there who are year-round, five or six people, because there's always projects, always things falling apart on a farm, always office work to do. We have 1,300 families that we take care of, so that's about 5,000 people that we're feeding during the growing season. You got to prepare for all of that during the off-season. And then we have interns who come and learn about farming and spend a season there. And then now we have a lot of people who live in the area who are our hourly help during the season. They come back year after year. About three-quarters of our people are there year after year. Then there's the shareholders who come out and volunteer. That's not a really big part of our labor force, but it's significant because they get to have a relationship to the farm. There's the CSA Learning Center that does the educational programs for the farm, and they reach thousands. There are thousands and thousands of people come to that farm every year to visit. Often people who have never been on a farm before. And then another really big part of what has made the operation work is that the shareholders pooled their money to buy us needed land. That's a lot of involvement, isn't it? It's a lot of community involvement.
It certainly is. You must have more shareholders than any other CSA I've ever heard of.
Yeah, we do.
You deliver to about 25 drop sites in the Chicago area. Chicago's about, 75 miles from where your farm is. Chicago and city and suburbs. And in looking at the map on your website and remembering the geography as best I can, I lived in Chicago over 20 years ago, it seems like the sites are pretty much in white, middle, and upper-class areas. How do you feel about the demographics of your customers?
CSA is tends to be supported by the affluent. Farms need money. Now, if there's a disconnect there, if something's being overlooked, which certainly a case can be made for that, it shouldn't be on the farmer's shoulders. Absolutely shouldn't. It's so hard to stay in business, and money powers farms. Now, in our case, in our farm, the CSA Learning Center sponsors low-income shares. They go out and they get funding, and then they subsidize these low-income shares, and then they pay us, and then we supply that. They want to have 20% of our program, 20% of our membership be low-income shares within just a few years. But it's a big problem. I mean, farms go down because they don't have money. And then if farmers are going, well, I feel really compelled to have an expensive share, well, that's a great impulse to have. And if the farmer can afford to do it, can figure out how to do it, fine. But mostly what I notice about farms is a shortage of capital. And we face that ourselves. we need about $60,000 a month to keep afloat. And so we're always looking for ways to, you know, to make that happen, to be more efficient. And it's certainly one of the things we look at is, can we charge more? And then if we start going, but then certain people won't be able to get it, well, then you know what? What do we do? Do we let the farm go, or how do we deal with that? It's a big issue.
Okay. Well, the shareholders, the other people who actually work on the farm, they have some recipes. And your name is on the book, The Real Dirt on Vegetables. You're the author, and it's not just a book of recipes. There's a lot of other stuff in there, your writings, other people's writings. But you're here touring for this book, so let's talk about the cookbook. John, what do you like to eat?
What
do you like
a
salad? Do you like to cook your vegetables? Is cooking a chore for you, or do you like to do it?
Oh, I'm not a premier cook. I like to have other people cook. In fact, in this cookbook, the recipes are tested by people like our shareholder chefs, our culinary experts who I really trusted. And what motivated the cookbook was we needed to have recipes, a compilation of recipes for our shareholders. But the role I wanted to take on with the book, besides providing these recipes, we shareholders had submitted hundreds of recipes over the years for our newsletters. And then our cooks on the farm had come up with recipes, and we thought, oh, let's compile all of this and give it to our shareholders because they need a guide. Then the next thing was I went, but wait a minute, that's not enough. We have to make this, we have to really expand this, and we have to give people a relationship to the farm and give them an idea of where the vegetables come from. And there's this great treasure, Rudolf Steiner, who is very under-recognized and I'd say to a certain degree misunderstood, and we need to bring some of that in. So really my role with the cookbook was more to broaden people's relationship to the food, and then I assigned the task of testing and tweaking and adjusting and all of that to these people whose culinary instincts I really trusted. So, and it's interesting because I've never really been a salad eater. When I was little, salad, here, this is, I only have one child abuse story. Salad was forced on me. I could not stand it. And my sister would always notice if I didn't take the salad, and she would always tell my mother that I had to take my salad. And I couldn't stand it. And it really stays with me till this day, even though I do make my efforts to eat salad. But it's just something, you know, maybe I should get psychoanalysis about this thing. I'm in my 50s now, and I still have a problem with salad.
What do you like to eat?
Oh, I love the mainstream things like winter squash. It's one of my favorites. Sweet corn. Melons. A lot of those high summer crops I get very excited about.
Are you a vegetarian?
No, I'm not a vegetarian. This cookbook is all about vegetables. But one of the things in the cookbook that we make really clear is people need to make their own choices. There's no proselytizing in this cookbook. In fact, in one of the opening pages, Rudolf Steiner says, "What one must have above all in science is respect for human freedom. One should never have the feeling that anyone is ordered or forbidden to do something. Instead, one tells him the facts, and then what is right, the person finds out for himself." So, I'm not a vegetarian. I know this is a really big issue for a lot of people, and this is absolutely a cookbook about vegetables because that's what we raise, but there's no proselytizing about vegetarianism in
here. Now, you mentioned Steiner a lot. Is your farm certified, biodynamically certified?
No, we're not certified because we don't have enough of a animal base on the farm. You're supposed to have a balanced animal and plant combination, and we really don't have that, but we're not certified, but we do go continually more and more in the direction of biodynamics. Now we're making our own preps on the farm, and we just keep looking at that year after year. I want to say a few things about this cookbook. It was such a huge job, and it's interesting now because I was so involved in it over so many years while I was running the farm, while this film was getting crafted, and I'm actually thrilled that it came together the way that that it came together. And it's a large book. I mean, there's 350 pages. And I'm still kind of familiarizing myself with the vision that's actually crystallized here as a book that we can turn the pages of. But it has a lot of things, I think, that are really great for CSA members, like it has, because one of the things about people who join a CSA is they're not familiar with all the vegetables that they're going to get. And we have an illustrated vegetable identification guide. And so people can get this, their vegetables that week, and they can go, well, what is this? What is this? Oh, it's like licorice. Oh, it's fennel. And we have garlic scapes in here in this guide. Well, we have a vegetable storage guide. Very important. How do you really keep these things? There's also a kind of a seasonal guide, so you can get a feeling of the seasonality of these different crops. And this book is organized according to seasons, seasons being early, mid, and late season, not winter, spring, because we just have a 20-week growing season. But we give the feeling of a continuum in how these crops come about, so people relate to the seasonality of the crops. And that's very important, because sometimes, you know, a new shareholder might write in June and say, where are my tomatoes? I signed up because I wanted tomatoes. Well, here's a seasonal guide. You should just check it out. You could have seen that before you signed up, but you have to wait for the tomatoes.
So no proselytizing, but educating, definitely.
Yeah, there's educating. Some of my essays are in here. And then we have recipes for some of the more unusual things that people maybe wouldn't normally buy, but the shareholders are going to probably end up with, like sunchokes, Jerusalem artichokes, daikon, celeriac. A lot of people are not attracted to Brussels sprouts, but we give people Brussels sprouts. They love our Brussels sprouts because they go through frost several times before we harvest them. They get very sweet, and I think most Brussels sprouts that people can buy in the store never go through a frost cycle.
Let's talk about the movie a little bit. You had a friend, college friend, I guess, who was already making films, videos, whatever, and is now a filmmaker. Tell us about your connection with him and how this movie happened. I think many of the listeners have seen the movie The Real Dirt on Farmer John. Many more may not have, and it will be coming back. I think it's going to be going further, actually, around the world, and you can tell us about that.
Well, I met Taggart Siegel, the director of the film, in, I think it was 79, and that was just a couple of years before the farm really started to go down. And he was already doing some filming on the farm, and he was very excited about encountering the farm. He saw it as a creative place for making films. And then he documented the auction. He documented the liquidation of my equipment, and he was there for a very morbid time in my life, and then we were friends after that, and he filmed me randomly, and then sometimes put me in his short films, sometimes I helped make those films, and then when the farm came back to life, which we just thought was such an extraordinary event, for this farm to actually come back and show life again, and much healthier life than it had presented before, that's when we realized that we should make this documentary. And there was a tremendous amount of footage from Taggart shooting, my shooting, my mom's shooting, and then he started filming very intentionally in 96.
Knowing Taggart certainly helps, but from what I saw in the movie, you have an artistic streak to you, or at least recognize the value of art. But on the other hand, also, you like to drive tractor, and you like machinery. I don't know if these are two different sides of the brain or what's going on here.
Well, in the key art for the film, you see those two sides of my personality. You see me in, you see Farmer John and you see Farmer Elton John in the leopard, the synthetic leopard coat with the derby and the pink boa. And, I have these two sides, and I've certainly tried to integrate them on the farm. It's hard because the farm wants everything, and a farm generally requires be no nonsense and practical and very committed and often over the top. And then in addition to that, I've been very inspired to write my life and then to be in this film, and then somehow these music videos slipped into the whole process, and I decided that's an important outpouring or expression for a farm also, to have music videos emanate from a farm. So I do have these two sides, and they do seem like they're in conflict sometimes, and then sometimes they seem like they're working well together. I want to say we're building a new web page. My website is going to be the same, www.angelicorganics.com, but we're building out this new page. And the new page is really going to express how this farm give rise to such a wide sweep of things, not just vegetables, but also film, books, and music. And I love that a farm can be that kind of an emanation, because a lot of people think you better get off the farm if you're going to go have a creative life. But I think a farm can generate a creative life because it is in itself a creative force. It's a creative organism. So we've been able finally to demonstrate that a farm can give rise to all of that. And it's actually been good for me to break away from the farm. I've redeemed the farm. The farm is back on its feet. And I don't want to be, I don't have to be the one who's at the head of it. I don't have to be the one who's doing it. I am thrilled that that farm is a viable farm again. It's a vibrant farm. It means so much to me. But the fact that it's back on its feet and it's proving that it can get along without me is very liberating for me, because there are a lot of creative projects that I want to be involved in. And I tell you, I get on a tractor, I get so mesmerized. So my it's all, you know, I know I'm not glorifying it by calling it an addiction, but it's such an affinity, it's such a strong affinity, and it's been good to break up that pattern so I can look at other things for my life.
All right. The movie is called The Real Dirt on Farmer John. It's I'll be a reviewer here. It's a very good story, well told. And the cookbook is Cookbook and More is The Real Dirt on Vegetables. John Peterson, thank you very much for coming into KBOO.
It's great to be here again.
Thanks, John.
Thanks to all of
thank
you.
Thank you.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that. Once again, Farmer John's website, or the farm's website, is angelicorganics.com. And unfortunately, you cannot use that to order vegetables. They're not going to deliver here to Oregon. But it is an interesting website. And we also want to thank KBOO PM News Director Lisa Loving for providing Farmer John with a purple boa. Now we're going to take a little trip. Kate?
Yeah, farmers markets in Portland are open and going strong. So this month, the Interstate Market is in its second season at Overlook Park on the Yellow Max Line. The market started when the Overlook Neighborhood Association and Kaiser Permanente got together and made it happen. Vendors greeted us with their products when Roberta and I visited on a recent Wednesday.
The Interstate Farmers Market is beginning its second year. We operate every Wednesday afternoon from 3 to 7. Every week we have a musician who's performing. There's some great organic and fresh produce that's picked this morning that you can buy today and cook for dinner tonight. Asparagus is in season right now.
Asparagus, I mean, is very, very simple. You can stir fry it. You can put a little olive oil and a little fresh garlic on it and just like steam it in the microwave. We've got white asparagus. We have the green asparagus right now. One thing that I found today was the ends of the elephant garlic.
Well, we have mostly the cool season crops right now. So we've got a lot of kale, cabbage, collards. Sweet peas have been out for a few weeks now. Saute them lightly with some olive oil or butter, just enough to get them hot.
That's really nice lettuce.
Good, yes. The prices are fantastic. Look at that.
Just asparagus, and we're located in Eltopia, Washington, which is about 30 miles north of Tri-Cities.
What do you do with your asparagus when you eat it?
Barbecue. Jumbo's is what I recommend. But I also do the small ones, too, on the grill. Olive oil, garlic. I like pepper. It's just about 5 minutes tops because this stuff cooks really fast. I don't have to cut anything off of my petite ones. The big ones, you do have to cut off a little bit off the bottom, but that's it. I wouldn't even peel them.
I have had some asparagus, yes. It is wonderful.
How did you prepare it?
I stir fry it, or I steam it first.
and then leave it in the refrigerator because I can use it lots of different ways. I can throw it in a stir fry. I can stick it in a salad. I can do many different things with it.
We do several markets here in the metro area. So
we're selling guacamole, handmade guacamole, handmade chips, and juices today.
I love this market. I love all the markets, actually. And my bread's selling well. And
we have wild morel mushrooms, and those are from the Blue Mountains in eastern Oregon. And then we have our cultivated shiitake and our cultivated maitake from our farm in St. Helens. I love the maitake mushroom. You, you break it apart and saute it or stir-fry it or put it in miso soup or barbecue it or roast it, but it's really medicinal as well as absolutely delicious.
At the market, we have our fresh breads. We get all of our grains out of the state of Washington. The farmer mills them himself. That particular loaf is our garlic and three cheese. It is a split loaf, and there are whole cloves of garlic, Asiago cheese, Parmesan cheese, and mozzarella cheese. It's retopped from the split and then baked. It's a decadent loaf of bread.
We're mostly selling just raw honeys and different honey-based products.
We sell a lot of zucchini and a lot of random little kinds of squash.
Do you know about squash blossoms? They're very good if you put a soft cheese in them, like feta or goat cheese or mozzarella, and then you can batter them in several things. You can do a tempura, a pancake, or a cornstarch batter, and then you fry them real quick in olive oil. Very succulent dish for you.
If everything doesn't take that you plant by seed, you can come by here and pick up some starts.
And from Greenpeace, a team from Greenpeace is shutting down an illegal soy export facility in the heart of the Amazon rainforest today. The soy, which is exported to Europe as animal feed, is grown in deforested areas of the Amazon rainforest. Climbers are trying to occupy the roof and conveyor belts of the Cargill export facility. Volunteers are trying to prevent soy from being unloaded from barges into the facility, and the Arctic Sunrise, which is the Greenpeace ship, is attempting to occupy the dock of the facility, preventing barges of soy from arriving and unloading, but is being rammed by a cargo vessel. Cargo workers at the dock are being violent, and one activist has been thrown into the river. Eight people have been arrested so far. So soy is now a leading cause of rainforest destruction in the Brazilian Amazon.
Thank you for that news, Kate. Well, that concludes the food show, the KBOO Food Show for June. We're on the third Monday of every month. We'll be on July 17th, Monday at 10 a.m. here on KBOO. Thanks to my colleagues, Kate and Roberta, our engineer, Tammy, and always thanks to KBOO's AM News and Public Affairs Director, Kathleen Stephenson. The music you're hearing in the background is called Too Many Cooks. It's by Michael Locke and the Repeat Offenders. Stay tuned now for Democracy Now! Here on KBOO 90.7 in Portland.
Actually, written by Willie Dixon.
Written by Willie Dixon. Okay, thank you. Bye now.
Gilbert and Sullivan Father's Day Special will be Friday, June 23rd, from 11 p.m. to midnight. W.S. Gilbert wrote the words and Sir Arthur Sullivan wrote the music for these satirical Victorian operettas. Tune in if you enjoy British humor, wordplay, twins switched at birth, pirates, and falsified beheadings. Anyone who supports marriages between men and fairies should definitely mark their calendars for Friday, June 23rd, because you won't want to miss the Gilbert and Sullivan Father's Day Special here on KBOO.
It's just past 11 here on KBOO Portland. Coming right up, it's Democracy Now!, featuring today an interview with Carol Williams, one of three journalists the U.S. has barred from the military prison at Guantanamo Bay
Also, New York Times columnist Paul Krugman speaks on the new class war in America, all coming up on Democracy Now! Momentarily. Thanks for tuning into the Radio Zine today.